I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is predicting an above-normal hurricane season this year, forecasting as many as 20 named storms, 6 to 12 hurricanes, and 3 to 5 major hurricanes. Currently, Tropical Storm Elsa is heading to Florida. The warming planet, including rising and warming seas, is influencing the ferocity of these storms, the amount of precipitation, and their destructive impact. Joining us is Kevin Reed. He is associate professor in the School of Marine and Atmospheric Sciences at Stony Brook University, who studies the connection between extreme weather changes and climate change. Kevin Reed, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Last year, we had 30 named storms. We went through the alphabet, or the American alphabet, and had to start with another alphabet. Obviously, NOAA is predicting something less than that. How do they do that? How do they know?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, from year to year, the amount of hurricanes and the strength that hurricanes can have in the North Atlantic can vary in a similar way in which, right, in some winters are worse than others, and sometimes we get feet of snow, and sometimes we don't get any snow. And so in a similar way, hurricanes change from season to season, and it's often driven by large-scale circulations around the globe. One typical one is El Nino and La Nina. Oscillations can really affect the number of storms in the North Atlantic. And so this year, NOAA, as you mentioned, is predicting an active but not quite as active season as last year, and that in part comes from the fact that we are kind of what we call a neutral El Nino phase that might lead to a La Nina phase in which it comes more favorable for tropical cyclones to occur in the North Atlantic.
What does the role of either warming seas or rising seas have on hurricanes?
Yeah, so, you know, we know of a variety of ingredients that are important for the environments that lead to hurricanes. One of the important ones is the temperature of the upper ocean, so the layer near the surface, not just the surface, but it can go down, you know, maybe 20, 30, 40 feet. How warm that layer is really important as providing the fuel to tropical cyclones. And so the warmer the waters are, the more likely a tropical cyclone can form. And this is exactly why hurricanes start to form this time of year, because that's when the ocean temperatures in the North Atlantic are their warmest.
And how much variation is that? I mean, and I was reading that, you know, 1 degree temperature increase on the surface of the ocean can have a pretty big impact.
Yeah. And so if you look at climate change to date, so the amount of temperature that the global average temperature has increased over the last 100 plus years due to human-induced greenhouse gases, we see an increase of about 1 degree Celsius, or so, you know, much over a 1 degree Fahrenheit. And these increases we can show are actually leading to more intense and particularly more heavy rainfall within recent storms. And so some of the work that my research group does at Stony Brook, as well as other groups around the world, is trying to really calculate, you know, how much has rainfall changed in storms recently. And some of the best numbers are showing anywhere between kind of 5+% of the amount of rainfall in an individual tropical cyclone or individual hurricane, such as Florence or Michael or Harvey, are producing, you know, maybe in some cases an inch or more of rain that's coming from this increase in sea surface temperatures due to human-induced emissions.
In fact, you use modeling. What then explains the increase in precipitation?
Yeah, and so this is coming directly from the increase in the upper ocean temperature. So the warmer the ocean temperature is, the more of that moisture can get into the atmosphere. And once it's in the atmosphere and it's within the circulation of a tropical cyclone, it allows for more rainfall to occur, deeper thunderstorms, which ultimately leads to not only higher rainfall rates, but also larger amounts of accumulated rainfall over the lifetime of the storm. And so high rainfall rates are really important, you know, for a given instant. But also when storms can sometimes slow down, or if they take interesting paths like we're seeing with Tropical Storm Elsa, you can have a really large impact on dumping a lot of rainfall over a period of time.
So can we say climate change causes more intense hurricanes?
So what we can say is that climate change increases the likeliness of intense hurricanes, and also increases the amount of rainfall that falls in a given hurricane by over 5%.
But what's so interesting is that climate change also seems to cause drought. I'm thinking about the western part of the United States that's currently under a drought crisis.
Yeah, and so, you know, the Earth system is a very complex system. And so when you have more moisture available in certain regions because you have warmer surface temperatures, that can induce changes in the large-scale circulation, which can impact, allowing less rainfall to fall in other parts of the globe. And so, you know, these kind of increases in the rainfall and tropical cyclones and maybe increases in the frequency or longevity of droughts in the western United States, these are actually clear metrics of climate change. We'd expect both of these things to happen as the globe warms in the way it has.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Kevin Reed. He is associate professor in the School of Marine and Atmospheric Sciences at Stony Brook University. The first of two guests in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about the warming oceans. We'll be talking about deep ocean in just a couple of minutes. And if you want to join our conversation, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Kevin, as we know, so many Americans, and we're talking about America now, have moved to, you know, coastal communities, that we have moved into the path of some of these really intense and powerful hurricanes or tropical storms. I mean, if we weren't there, would we be having this conversation?
Well, I think we'd still be having this conversation because, in part, you know, human society has always lived near the coast for certain reasons, particularly since, in part, they're the focus of our economy. It allows, it's great for transportation and it's great for tourism and our food system. And so we would be having these conversations, but, you know, one of the things is can we, as we go into the next decade or two, can we start to build our coast in a way that's more sustainable and makes them more resilient to these type of events? Of course, if you look at Hurricane Harvey from a few years ago, this is also true from Hurricane Katrina from 2005. You know, the part of the reason they were so damaging is where they made landfall, right? They affected large metropolitan areas. And of course, if they made landfall not in large metropolitan areas, they wouldn't have been impactful from a dollar standpoint. But they'd still be changing, and they're still changing in terms of their intensity and rainfall. And so ultimately, we have to prepare our coastlines for these type of events. And so we have to build more resilient, more green, more sustainable infrastructure so that we're better prepared for these type of storms in the future. And because I'll just finish with, even if we start to reduce our carbon emissions drastically over the next decade or two, we've ultimately already had over a degree of warming globally from human-induced climate change. And so it is going to be important that we still adapt our coastlines to be better prepared for future tropical cyclones and hurricanes.
I remember doing a show a couple of years ago on planned retreat, the idea that, you know, that it's really unsustainable to live on our coast. But you're saying there are things that we can do to protect ourselves from these storms. Obviously, we have to reduce our CO2 emissions. But in the meantime, we've got to figure out how to, I guess, coexist with these storms.
Yeah. And I would say that, you know, the solution and the way that you become more resilient will depend upon your city and your region of the United States. And maybe planned retreat is a good option for you. Maybe it's a necessity, but maybe, you know, building a storm barrier or building more natural protection in your coastline is the way to go. And so it really will depend on your community.
I was also reading about storm rapid intensification, that we seem to be seeing that also with these storms. What is that?
Yeah, so rapid intensification is something that can happen in storms. Particularly, our most intense storms often have undergone rapid intensification. And this is just a very quick, rapid, abrupt change in the intensity of a storm kind of over a 24-hour period. And so ultimately, this can occur for when you have warmer ocean temperatures. That's one way in which these ingredient that leads to rapid intensification. And so that's another thing that we'd expect, actually, based if we go back to what I said a few minutes ago, right, that the increase in likelihood of intense storms due to climate change is happening. Part of that is coming from rapid intensification potentially becoming more frequent. And so that means more storms can undergo rapid intensification, which can lead to these major kind of category 3, 4, and 5 storms.
And I also remember some of these storms that just stall. I mean, they don't move.
Yeah, and so that's something that we've definitely seen recently, right? We saw that with Hurricane Dorian, we saw that with Hurricane Florence and Harvey recently, and these storms all dumped well over, multiple feet of rainfall in the Carolinas and Texas and the Bahamas. And this kind of combination of more rainfall in addition to storms that can slow down, can really lead to these crazy amounts of rain. I mean, 3 feet of rainfall in a few day period
Unimaginable.
is unimaginable. And so there is an active research going on to understand, is this type of slowdown in storms, particularly as they come near the coastline, is that something that could be climate change related? And so that's an active area of research within the community to try to understand, in addition to rainfall changes, are the tracks as well as the translation speed, how fast our storms are moving, is that changing due to climate change?
I'm assuming you use modeling to look back on a storm to see about its impact, but obviously we need better, probably more accurate forecasting into the future if we're going to be looking at, serious storm seasons.
Yeah, and so, forecasting often depends upon models, and so building the best models that we can do for prediction of storms, not only when they're happening, but even maybe, in an ideal world, maybe 2 weeks out, right? So if we knew a storm was coming, could we better prepare our areas where we think it might make landfall? That's continually improved. We've definitely seen significant improvement over the decades in what we call track error. This is, how 3 or 4 days out are we able to predict where the storm is going to be? And that's come through constant improvement in our forecast models. But in addition, we also have a whole set of models that are used to project out decades into the future under assumed scenarios of how greenhouse gases and how different aspects of the climate change system will change. And those models have also continually been improving. And we're starting to enter an era where we can maybe start to use those type of models to start to maybe predict or project, the numbers of storms in given basins in the future and how that might change compared to what it has been historically.
We're almost out of time here. I read looking into the future, fewer storms but stronger storms. Does that square with your understanding?
Yeah, so that squares with the consensus within the scientific community, in the sense that we're confident that the storms are going to become stronger. We're confident that the amount of rainfall within those storms is increasing. And the projections, these type of climate models that are run out into the future are suggesting that the number of storms might be decreasing. But I want to just acknowledge that, the average number of storms in the North Atlantic is, of hurricanes, about 13 to 14 ish per year. And so if you have 12 per year instead of 13, that's a decrease. But if they're stronger and if they're impacting land, right, that decrease is probably less important than the fact that they're becoming much stronger and dumping more rainfall.
Well, Kevin Reed, thanks for getting our conversation started. Thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Great. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Coming up, the deep ocean. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscoena, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. There is a hidden world of hydrothermal vents, giant underwater mountains, canyons, and caverns so deep that light does not penetrate this ocean environment. It's home to countless unimaginable life forms. Vampire squid, sneezing sponges, bone-eating worms, snail-eating amphipods, deep-diving sperm whales, bioluminescent jellyfish, sea cucumbers called gummy squirrels. That's what Dr. Helen Scales writes in her new book, The Brilliant Abyss. Now, humans are just beginning to explore this diverse ecosystem, learning about the role it plays in keeping the Earth in balance. The deep ocean is also being threatened by our trash, by deep-sea fishing, and deep-sea mining. Dr. Helen Scales is a marine biologist, writer, and broadcaster. Joins us by Skype from England. And Dr. Helen Scales, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hello, Marty. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you're very welcome. Some very basic questions just to get us started here. So, how deep is the deep ocean?
So it's very deep is my simple answer. But to put some numbers on it, and I'm going to have to try and convert this because in my head I'm thinking in meters, but perhaps you can help me out here.
I'll try
the average depth of the oceans is around about 4 kilometers. So 4,000 meters, if that's helpful for you, is the average depth. But it goes a lot deeper. We have that's the deepest parts of these amazing trenches, which dive down many, many miles. And the very deepest one we know of is the Mariana Trench. A lot of them are in the Pacific, many of them deeper than 10 kilometers. And this one is just shy of 11 kilometers. So actually, I could put that into my computer and work out what that is.
We have people, I think, who can do that for us. But let's keep going. I was also reading, just to sort of underscore, 2.4 miles. There we go. 4 kilometers is the same as 2.4 miles. I was also reading, I mean, in terms of an American audience, something like 7 miles down just to...
That's right. Yeah, it's about 7 miles to the very deepest point. I've just got that too. Yeah. So let's think about a 7 mile hike downwards to the bottom of the ocean is what we've got. Yes.
And just to add to this drama, the pressure down there is 400 times the pressure on the surface.
Yeah, the pressure just ramps up and up. It just goes as you go. The pressure of the water column above wherever you are in the deep ocean is just adding to that that pressure squashing down on you. So yeah, by the time you get to the abyss, so around that kind of 2 mile mark roughly, we're talking the pounds per square inch that would be equivalent of an elephant essentially stepping on every square inch of your body. So just extraordinarily extreme conditions.
And it's so deep that light can penetrate so far into the ocean, but we're talking about a part of the ocean that is what? Absolutely pitch black?
Well, pitch black of sunlight, definitely. I mean, the official beginnings that I guess the scientists see it, and also because of the changes in light conditions, the official beginning of the deep sea is around the 6,000 feet mark. 660 feet is roughly where we begin what we call the twilight zone, which does have a little bit of sunlight left. It's that very deep blue wavelengths of light that make it down to that depth. And so it's constantly like during the day, it's like walking out at night and looking at the sky, that kind of beautiful, clear twilight night, you know, early evening, that kind of thing. But then when you get down to the midnight zone, so that's down at around 3,300 feet, there's no sunlight at all left. It's permanently dark. But actually, there's no sunlight, but there is light. There's a lot of light because animals make light.
That's right.
And it's like it's almost compulsory for it. It turns out scientists have found, you know, it's something like 75% of the animal life that occupies the water column all the way through the deep ocean are bioluminescent. They are able to make their own light. So you've got sparkles and fireworks and glowing animals here and there. So there is light, just not from the sun.
Well, I'm a radio person, so I always want to know what things sound like. What does it sound like in the Mariana Trench? Do we know?
Oh, that's a very good question. I know that there are some hydrophones that are rigged up, and I think you can kind of tune in online and actually listen to what the deep ocean sounds like. The oceans are surprisingly noisy. Animals down in the deep or anywhere in the ocean make various different sounds. I don't know if sound is a critically important way of communicating between animals in the deep, but I'm sure things do make noises, feeding noises, popping, squeaking, various different sort of just the life is noisy generally. I know there are some fairly unexplained noises in the deep ocean too. You get some great sort of repetitive, strange, loud sounds, which sometimes actually are really hard to explain. It could be geological. Of course, we dream about sea monsters and things in the bottom of these deep trenches too, which generally so far haven't come true. But you never know what we might find next.
Well, they're just, you have photographs in this book, and they're just, I mean, they're indescribable. As you say, you know, countless unimaginable life forms that are living in this deep ocean. What does it take, I mean, to survive? And I'll put out as an example, you describe a female octopus who doesn't eat for 5 years in order to be able to brood their eggs.
It's extraordinary. I mean, especially when you consider that normally octopuses in shallower seas will only live for a couple of years in total. So, you know, that's leading up to the point where they're having babies and laying eggs and so on. But in the deep ocean, life is very different. It's a very slow life often. We find a lot of animals living in the deep live for a very long time. We've got some real record breakers in terms of longevity down there. We have Greenland sharks, which are the longest lived animals with backbones. So they can, we think, live for at least 500 years. These are great, big, huge sharks. Mm. Down to things like some of the, really some of the longest lived animals on the planet. We've got deep sea corals. You might think of corals as being something that, you know, we know, we're familiar with them in beautiful tropical coral reefs up at the surface. But more than half of the species of corals actually live in the deep ocean down in the dark. And some for a really very long time. I think 4,200 years is the longest measured lifespan for a coral colony, a black coral that lives down in the deep. Many others, there's gold corals which live for thousands of years. Extraordinarily long-lived creatures. And I think that's part of what's so fascinating and wonderful about life in the deep, is because of these crazy conditions of no light, incredible pressure, everything's adding up to it being a very different place to be. And the responses to that in terms of how life has evolved is just mind-blowing. Things live for a long time because it's a hungry place. There's no new food in most of the deep ocean being made, so you have to make do, and hanging around and having a very low metabolic rate and just kind of hanging out until the next meal comes along is a kind of a strategy that works for deep sea creatures. So you see that quite a bit.
Well, you mentioned survival and eating something. Describe for our listeners what marine snow is, because it seems without this life might be pretty difficult in the deep ocean.
Yeah, marine snow is the key to almost everywhere in the deep ocean in terms of the food that's being injected into these ecosystems. And it was only really kind of figured out in the 1950s and onwards just how important this stuff is. It looks like snow. So if you go down into the deep ocean, you put down maybe a submersible, switch the cameras on with the lights shining through the water, and you'll see this drifting white kind of fluffy particles drifting slowly down from above, hence the name. It was actually Rachel Carson, the amazing American writer, who she coined that word, the marine snow. And it was picked up by scientists. I mean, she didn't really know what it was at that point, but scientists later on, some Japanese scientists who went down in a Saab and looked out the window, and they were like, okay, we're going to call this stuff marine snow, just like Carson did. So it's basically dead plankton, the remains of those animals that live up in the surface, tiny little plants and animals that are so important in surface seas, as well as their droppings. And there's like a kind of a microbial glue. It just sounds delicious, I know, but this kind of glue sticks them together into these fluffy particles, which then drift down. And it's really an incredibly important source of carbon and food for the deep ocean. It trickles down, and there are animals all the way through the water column, all the way down, who are catching it, who are grabbing it, sifting it from the water. Others who are sitting on the seabed and finding piles of this stuff. So sea cucumbers, that gummy squirrel that you mentioned, will basically kind of roam around the abyss, finding piles of marine snow to munch on. And, you know, at most around 2% of the food that's made at the surface will make it down into the deep ocean. So it's not a lot. So, yeah, it is a hungry place. But if you can find a way, you know, if organisms can find a way of eating this stuff, it's a really important source of food. And you get kind of seasonal changes in this too. It's not a kind of constant drift. If there's a bloom of algae, for example, at the surface, that will come down in a big kind of snowfall into the deep, and that's important food. And there are times when there's less and times when there's more. So it's a critically important part of those ecosystems.
Extraordinary. Let me just reintroduce you. That's Helen Scales. She's a marine biologist. She's written a couple of books, and she's got a new one. It's called The Brilliant Abyss, Exploring the Majestic Hidden Life of the Deep Ocean and the Looming Threat that Imperils It. And we will talk about various threats, actually. But in the meantime, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Any questions or comments? You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes to join our conversation. Let me just ask you about a couple of more creatures that live in the deep. Yeti crabs. What are yeti crabs?
Oh, they're one of my favorites.
I got that feeling, yes.
Can you guess from the book?
Yes, I did.
Just the name of them sounds wonderful too. And I kind of start off the chapter about yeti crabs saying, wouldn't it be wonderful if they did eat marine snow? I mean, I think that would just be really poetic. But no, alas, no. But actually more interesting, they do something very strange. I mean, their name comes from the fact when they were discovered, you know, scientists looked at them and they're like, well, they're like a cross between a yeti, obviously, and a crab. They've got these big, long, white, hairy arms. they live on hydrothermal vents, these extraordinary ecosystems systems miles down beneath the surface, which were only discovered just about 40 years ago, equivalent basically of boiling hot springs. These are cracks in the seabed where these incredibly hot fluids pour up from down below, much, much hotter than the ones on land. We're talking hundreds of degrees because the pressure means that it doesn't actually boil. So you can get a lot hotter down in the deep ocean because of that huge pressure. And when they were discovered, no one was expecting to find life on hydrothermal vents. These are toxic, like low oxygen, really nasty places. And yet it was flourishing. Wow. The first one they looked at, there was flourishing with life. And these things are all through the oceans, all along the edges of tectonic plates, where plates in the deep ocean are pulling apart in the seabed. And wherever you go in different parts of the world, you'll find different animals living. It's like different mountain ranges, really. And these Yeti crabs have been found in various parts of the Pacific. And basically, they survive by they grow microbes, back bugs, basically, in those furry arms. And then they eat those microbes. That's how they survive. So they don't eat snow. They have this kind of microbial way. And the really crazy thing that was discovered on these vents is that these are microbes that survive in a way that's completely cut off from sunlight. It's an ecosystem that needs no energy from the sun at all, but creates its own energy in a completely different way. So instead of using sun's energy, as plants do, they use chemical energy. And it was the first time that ever been discovered back in 40 years ago. And it just, you know, blew apart the minds of biologists that this is a completely new way of living, of life surviving down there in the dark depths.
Well, you know, it just underscores the marvel of adaptation, right? That a living thing can adapt itself to this really harsh environment.
It does. I think it shows us. I think the lessons the deep show us, there's so many, but one in particular is that life will find a way. You know, whatever we humans might think of something as being in, you know, inhospitable or unlivable conditions, something will find a way. You know, a new way of surviving, new way of gaining food, finding a mate, all those sorts of things. You know, it shows us just the possibilities of life are much more than perhaps we ever realized.
Let me do one more animal. This is the sperm whale. They can dive as deep as 6,000 feet. And as you write, I mean, these were animals that really ruled the ocean. They still exist. But as you also write, that we need to think of them the way we think of polar bears or elephants. They need to be protected.
They do. I mean, sperm whales were heavily, heavily hunted, you know, from early times in when whaling was happening, but actually even more so in the 20th century. We don't kind of think so much about the more modern commercial whaling that happened up until the 1980s when it was stopped. And you know, in that modern era of hunting, it's been estimated that around 760,000 sperm whales were killed for their blood, for their fat, and for the oils in their heads. And the estimate of how many are left now is 360,000. So we killed more than there are alive now. It's very hard to know. Actually, doing a head count of sperm whales is difficult because they do spend about 3/4 of their lives down in the deep ocean. So they come up for a quick breath and then they go back down again. And they really are these extraordinary animals that are, yeah, they're air-breathing mammals just like us, but they have these amazing adaptations to go hunting for huge squid down in these deep depths, chasing after them. We now know quite a lot about how they have like echolocation, like bats, to see through these dark depths, and they're hunting for these fast-swimming squid, and they'll have these kind of chase scenes. We've got a really wonderful view of how these animals operate down there, and they can go down for an hour at a time. They have all this amazing store of oxygen in their muscles rather than in their lungs. Their lungs collapse after a few hundred feet, and it's all of this sort of store of oxygen they bring with them, this private supply, which means they can survive down there for so long. So that, you know, they're just extraordinary creatures, possibly really quite intelligent, using these sounds in ways that we still don't really understand. And yet, yeah, for a long, long time they were this industrial resource that were just killed in their thousands. But, you know, they are now protected, which is wonderful. Sure. And I think numbers should be recovering. But I think it goes to show how we can really change our views on animals on our planet, too, going from something that is kind of accepted that that's what we do. We kill them to, no, we don't. We protect them. And I think we could do with moving that on to lots of other animals and ecosystems on this planet as well.
Well, what's so exciting is that we now can explore the deep with remote operated underwater vehicles. We've got high definition, you know, live video. So help us understand what's happening thousands of feet below the Earth's surface, the ocean surface.
Yeah, I mean, we are in this golden age of science and discovery in the deep ocean. I think, as you say, because of these amazing technologies we now have, I mean, some people do get to go into the deep. It's a bit like space. I really kind of think there's a lot of parallels between how we explore and understand the outer space and the inner space of the deep ocean. You know, some people go, there is the ability to send humans, and that's really wonderful, and they bring back that, they make that human connection to these places. But really how we learn the most about the deep ocean is through these remote, incredible technologies to send robots on our behalf who bring back imagery and long-term kind of amazing surveys. So, I mean, right now there's a couple of organizations that have ships that go out and do deep sea research, and they have live link ups to the deep submersibles they send down. So you can sit, and I do this quite often, it's terrible for my work productivity, but so you can sit there and watch on YouTube and pretty much live. I mean, obviously it's got a ping around, if this is often the other side of the world, but within, you know, a few seconds, you know that that particular octopus that's sitting in front of your screen, on your screen, you know, it's several miles down, it's being watched by this camera, and it's there right now. And you're watching it, and the scientists are watching it and studying these incredibly remote places. So, I mean, I would say, like, what we're learning about the deep is just how full of life the deep ocean is, and how diverse not only is the life, but also the physical nature of that deep ocean. I mean, I kind of make this I describe in the book, if we were to empty all the water out of the ocean so we could see what the bottom of the sea looks like, it's, you know, we've got canyons and mountain ranges and great undulating plains, and it's not all the same. And no matter where you go, all different places in the ocean, you'll find different groups of animals, you'll find things living in different ways. It's very different to life out on land. We don't have those kind of, you know, hot tropical equators and cold poles. It's a lot more similar in terms of the temperatures, but there's this huge variety of what we find, and we're still really only just scratching the surface. It's not even the surface, is it? We're not scratching the depths on this, and there's almost all of the deep ocean has not yet been properly studied and looked at. So whenever we look, wherever we go, there are new species, there are new habitats, new ecosystems, new seamounts. I should mention those things, possibly millions of these enormous mountains in the deep ocean whose tops don't reach the surface. So they're very hard to find. You know, some of them we can find if they're big enough, we can find from space because they tug on the gravity so much that there's a slight bulge in the water above them and we can measure that. But there's just, you know, so much more topography, life down there that we're still discovering.
It's wonderful. Let's take another short break and we'll get back to our conversation with marine biologist Helen Scales. She's got a new book, The Brilliant Abyss, and we'll be talking about some of the threats to the deep ocean. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with marine biologist Helen Scales about the deep ocean. She is taking us thousands of feet below the ocean surface to the extraordinary life forms and largely unexplored world of the deep ocean. And again, her book is called The Brilliant Abyss. I do want to talk about some of the threats, but I want, before we get there, to understand the role that the deep ocean plays in making and helping to keep our planet habitable. You write, by its vast volume and restless motion, the superior heat-soaking nature of water, the ocean brings into balance Earth's interactions with the sun. Take us into this relationship.
So, yeah, I mean, imagine if, well, for one thing, just the oceans as a whole just soak up a huge amount of the extra heat that's trapped by human-emitted greenhouse gases. So if it wasn't already for the just sheer volume of the ocean, we would just be facing an extraordinarily unthinkable climate crisis. Like something, I think it's 30 degrees Celsius, which I believe is something like in the 60s for Fahrenheit, higher temperatures. We're talking, you know, we're worrying about a couple of degrees to change at the moment, but without the oceans, it would just be beyond that, far, far beyond that. So thankfully the oceans are there, and the deep ocean being the bulk of that volume is helping to soak up this heat that we are trapping on Earth. But even before climate change came along, I mean, the oceans, basically the deep ocean, is it's the circulation of our planet, really. If it wasn't for this, the fact that there was all this water moving around with great big rivers down through the deep ocean from the poles to the equator and on all the way through, it takes about 1,000 years for water to move an entire kind of lap of the planet, if you like, through each of the oceans, through the Atlantic, the Indian Ocean, the Pacific. And in that time, it's picking up the water mass, is picking up heat from the tropics, distributing it to other parts of the planet, taking cooler water from the poles and moving that around as well. And if it wasn't for that, then basically we'd have a very, very hot equator and very, very cold poles. And as it is, the deep is making much more of the planet habitable. So, I mean, here where I'm sitting here in Europe, we know very well that important currents coming across the Atlantic from your side of things is keeping things, you know, a lot more habitable than it would be for the latitude that we live at. And you know, that is changing, and there are shifts that are taking place because of melting glaciers, because of shifts in the salinity, which drives this. It's really a kind of a cold saline water is a real driving force for these big rivers that are moving heat, and at the same time oxygen and food around the oceans as well. So it's really the engine, the circulation of our planet is the deep ocean, and we have, you know, we have that to thank for, really, for where we can live and how we can live on this planet.
Well, let's talk about some of the threats. In fact, Luann comments, after reading an article about deep sea mining, she is concerned about the human impact on the deep sea, including the harvesting of metal-rich nodules. And you write a lot about the mining that's going on in the deep ocean. What's down there?
So, the nodules in particular that she mentions are scattered all the way through the abyss, a lot of them in the Pacific. They look like lumps of coal, basically, and they form over millions and millions of years as water, metals from the water, settle down on little nubbins, like sometimes like a shark tooth or a piece of whale ear bone will be the center of the nucleus for these things, and metals will settle down into these lumps that do contain a lot of precious metals, things like cobalt and nickel. And people for decades have been thinking about, well, could we go, you know, we've known about these for a long time, but could miners go along and pick, you know, extract these things and bring them up to the surface? Not only that, but also there are plans to mine hydrothermal vents, those the homes of Yeti crabs and so many other creatures. These tall black smoker chimneys, which form in these places, again have metal-rich rocks, and seamounts. These enormous mountains I mentioned too, that they're, you know, they have incredible life growing on them. Those ancient corals I mentioned too live. A lot of them live on seamounts and form these amazing kind of animal-grown forests, if you like. Huge, richly rich ecosystems are formed on these solid bits of habitat down in the deep. And they too have these metal-rich crusts, again, settling from the water over millions of years onto the surface of seamounts. And again, there are plans afoot to go down and extract those metals. Now, I should say that there is no deep sea mining up until this point. They haven't started yet, but there's a huge amount of interest, a lot of prospecting going on by many different countries around the world in different places. And it's looking like the race to the bottom, if you like, to start this process of mining the seabed could be really quite near now. Within a couple of years, we could see potentially, maybe, some countries are going to get permission to do this. And scientists and experts around the world are increasingly concerned that we really don't know. Well, we have an idea that this is going to have a really big impact on those ecosystems that rely on those, that live in those places, as well as processes that really underpin the health of the oceans much more widely as well. So it's really coming out that, you know, hundreds of us just recently signed a science statement on deep sea mining, saying that it's really too soon and that what we need is a good pause in this industry to let the science take place and give time to that science to understand what the threats are, what the needs are. Do we really need these metals at this point? And what would the impacts be without letting this go ahead and become the same old story of we go and do something without really understanding what the impacts are going to be first?
Well, here's where it gets complicated. Rechargeable batteries use cobalt. And, you know, we want to have rechargeable batteries to, you know, wean us off of fossil fuels. And there in the bottom of the ocean is cobalt.
Yeah, absolutely. Cobalt is one of the more controversial metals. At the moment, some electric car batteries do have cobalt in them. Cobalt is at the moment mostly mined in the Democratic Republic of Congo, in truly terrible conditions both for the environment and for human rights as well. So we all, you know, that's a bad thing. And looking to the deep ocean for an alternative cobalt source of cobalt, sure, is one thing to think about. But already many car manufacturers are looking at alternatives that don't require cobalt for various reasons. One being that the price spikes all over the place. So even for them, it's not a great, even right now, it's not a great option because the price can't be guaranteed. So Tesla, various other companies are looking to find lower cobalt requirements for their battery technologies, and even none at all. So I think for me, and that's one thing I really picked up on and spent quite a bit of time thinking and looking at when I was writing the book, was this idea of, well, what metals do we need for the green transition that we need to have? You know, to get ourselves off of fossil fuels, we are going to have a higher metal requirement for vehicles, for electric, for renewable energy generation, whether that's solar or wind power, those kinds of things. They all need different metal requirements. The thing I found, though, is that it's very difficult to predict what metals specifically are going to be needed. And there's a lot of innovation taking place in those sectors in terms of the technologies that are being used to generate really clean energy, to store it, to use it. And I do think that that's the hope we have, that there isn't this one set of metals that we definitely are going to need for the next 10, 20, 30 years in order to, you know, to get ourselves off of this fossil fuel addiction, and that we can have new ideas and really great, efficient and exciting new technologies could come through to do these things for us. But thinking really smartly about where those metals are going to come from, and for also how they're used afterwards, we need to think beyond just that initial use.
Sure.
And it, you know, this, the closing our manufacturing economies, thinking about reducing the need for primary metals, recycling, all these kind of things. I mean, it all has to be part of the solution. There's not one thing that's going to save us here, but I think smart thinking across the whole spectrum of, you know, production, use, and then reuse is going to be where we find the greatest and most you know, positive change when it comes to energy use and energy production.
Well, let me ask you about trash. Americans create a lot. Yeah, exactly. We create a lot of trash, as does the rest of the rest of the world. We've got microplastics. Does our trash eventually, or some of our trash, end up in the deep ocean, on the floor of the deep ocean?
Yeah, it does, unfortunately. And I guess in a way, almost inevitably, really. I mean, just simply by the fact that stuff gets blown or washed out of rivers into the ocean, and, you know, and anything that's negatively buoyant, anything that will sink, is going to end up down in the deep. So we are finding, unfortunately, we are finding plastics and various other trash down in the deeps, in some places concentrated in really high densities, simply because of kind of because of these currents and sort of almost like dust bowls that are blowing plastic particles together. So you've got some places in the Mediterranean where these incredibly high concentrations of plastic particles. I think I said that if you held open the pages of my book, it would be something like 100,000 particles of plastic just on those pages. It's, you know, really high. That's not the same everywhere, but some parts are really very contaminated. So that's getting there. Yep. And I mean, I think maybe a slightly more positive thing is that the oceans used to be used, the deep ocean was historically used as a dump site, just straight up. It's a nice, convenient, big place where we don't
have to look at it. Out of sight, out of mind, right?
Exactly. We can just throw stuff down there and we don't have to worry about it. You know, to the point where it was some pretty worrying stuff, you know, chemical weapons, nuclear waste, not so much the nuclear, but certainly chemical weapons. We think there's about 1 million tons of chemical weapons that were deliberately sunk down into the deep ocean. That has come to an end now. So it's one of the positive messages about the planet, I guess, is that when really bad things happen, you know, steps can be taken to rule that out and to say we don't do that anymore. So there is now illegal to deliberately dump just about everything into the deep ocean. Some organic things you can, if you need to, put them down there. But it's like a blanket no at this point. Sure. No deliberate dumping. So that's a good thing.
Well, let me ask you about one more threat, and I'm watching the clock here. Deep sea fishing and the impact of deep sea fishing on the deep ocean.
Yeah, so I mean, as we're overfishing shallower seas, as we all, I'm sure you've heard a lot about the problems of the fish stocks that we have up here on the shallows. It means that fishing has been pushing deeper and deeper into the ocean, and that's a pretty bad idea, because we've touched on this already. The long-lived species down in the deep ocean, the longer-lived an animal is, the less likely it's going to be a good target for sustainable fishing. It just makes it that much harder to keep populations keeping themselves healthy if we take some of them away. So there was, you know, the kind of the terrible sort of example of deep sea fishing is an animal called the orange ruffy, which was nowadays isn't fished so much, but mainly because they were collapsed. I shouldn't laugh, but these stocks, they live on seamounts, so they were targeted at these underwater mountains. And we now know that these little fish, they're, you know, plate-sized fish, nothing particularly, you know, huge. They can live for 250 years and wow. maybe not breed until then in their 40s.
Wow.
So this is not a sardine that's going to quickly, you know, its population is not going to quickly rebound. So again, it's one of these things, and we're finding there are moves to say, well, we must not fish too deep. I mean, in here in the EU, there are regulations that you can't trawl deeper than 900 meters, so around 3,000 feet, for example. And, you know, we really need to figure out fishing in the shallow seas. If we can sustainably fish the shallows, which we can do, we've got the science for that. It's merely a political and economic argument that's just standing in our way for that. If we can figure that out, there's no need to go into the deep ocean. We can leave that alone and leave those 100-year-old fish just to leave them be.
I'm curious about if you have a position, an opinion about wind turbines off, you know, off coasts of either America or, I mean, there you can see them in a number of countries. How does that impact the life under the ocean?
I'll admit I'm not I don't have my head in, right in that topic in terms of the exact impacts that can be. I know there are considerations that need to be looked into. I was speaking recently to somebody who knows a lot about sharks, for example, and he was telling me that, you know, we need to know more. We need to understand more about the electric cabling and the fields that are produced by these machineries. Because as you may know, sharks and rays and skates, their cousins, have very sensitive electrosensors. So this could be potentially something that they could pick up, maybe something that would deter them. We don't really know. So, you know, I would say things like that we need to know more about and be careful in citing these wind farms in areas that aren't already known to be, or, you know, look and check if they're important places for, say, shark breeding. You wouldn't want to go put one of those right in the middle of somewhere where these potentially really sensitive animals are going to not be very happy if these electric cabling and so on is put into their environment. So I think it's a case of really understanding the what the impacts could be and finding ways to avoid that and being really smart about that. And maybe, you know, just it's about knowing more, I think, before maybe going straight into deciding what's the best option in different places for that kind of thing.
I began the show talking with a different guest about the warming sea surfaces and its impact on extreme weather, things like hurricanes. Has the warming surface of the ocean in any way affected deep ocean?
We are looking more in terms of the climate impacts in the deep, and they certainly do penetrate down there, even though you might think it's so far down that it must be, you know, buffered from that. We know that the temperatures are increasing down to at least 2,000 meters at the moment, so 6,600 feet, that kind of thing. And I guess I'm kind of like looping back around to our discussion about the marine snow. I mean, that's the changes in the surface seas and temperature, also acidification, the CO2 absorbing into the water, into the sea and basically turning it more acidic. Those will have effects on the plankton, which are then going to, you know, fall down and feed those deep sea ecosystems. So that's one way which we think, you know, productivity, the food being made in the surface seas, if that changes, for good or bad, up or down, that is going to make its way into those deep sea ecosystems. So we do have these connections. I think that's one thing to take away from all of this is, you know, it's a long way, it's remote, it's someplace most of us are never going to see, but the deep ocean is connected to the shallows, it's connected to the rest of the planet, and it's driving so much of the health of everything, really. Nothing is aside and away on this earth of ours. It's all connected, it all matters, and those effects that we're having up here on land and in the atmosphere are going to make their way all the way to the very deepest parts of the ocean as well.
Well, that seems like the perfect place to end our conversation. Helen Scales, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. She is a marine biologist. She's a writer. She's a broadcaster. And she's got a new book. It's called The Brilliant Abyss, Exploring the Majestic Hidden Life of the Deep Ocean and the Looming Threat that Imperils It. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times. To find out more about the program, you can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. And we got thousands of them for you to listen to. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you for joining us.